Good morning, all. We are going to call this meeting to order, July 26, 2018. If everyone that is standing, if you can find a seat, that would be great. And for those that have cell phones, please turn them down. I'll put them into vibration, and that would be great. I'm gonna ask for roll call.
Alvarez, Bragg,
here.
Cole,
here.
Cox, Diaz,
present.
Donovan. Gomez,
here.
Hall,
here.
McClellan, McWhorter, Mendoza,
here.
Mullen,
here.
Rios,
here.
Salas,
here.
Zaff.
Thank you for all being here. Could I get a motion for approval of the minutes? Motion by President Cole and second by Ms. Braggs. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion moves unanimously. We have 7 public comment slips, and I am going to take them all this morning. So I'm going to call Valerie Hightower, following Martha Welsh. Yes, and if y'all can please line up to be a bit more efficient. And you're gonna have 2 minutes. All right, all righty.
Good morning, God bless. Here's the thing. There's no ridership on the 917, the 916, and the 4 because the buses aren't ran frequently enough. You guys would know this if you rode the transit. Another thing, you need public bathrooms. I know there's funding for it. Charge 50 cents. And here's another thing, the people that's getting tickets, let them clean the bathroom. That way you ain't got to pay them, let them work off their tickets. Another thing, why can't these dogs that's getting on these buses and trains be muzzled? You got new bus drivers that are smoking cigarettes and getting on those buses with the windows closed. I have lung issues, and that secondhand smoke is horrible in a closed-in bus. Well, I don't forget what I worked out. but here's the thing. We need to see more security on the trains, especially the green lines. And who's cleaning the bus stops? They're horrible. Southeast is treated like a second-hand child. You got kids that are trying to excel, but there's no help from the transit at all. But when they make it big, y'all saying, hey, he's from our city. Give them bus routes that they can get on, get to school, get to work, and excel. I don't know how long most of y'all been here, but Naraha, 30 years ago, used to be a drive-in crack dealership. It's done died. It's done changed. But I really, really appreciate if you guys would govern these dogs that's getting on these buses, the little ones would be in care, because not all of them dogs are service dogs. Thank you, and God bless y'all journey.
Thank you.
Martha Welch, the 2015, you had money for El Cajon, $30 million. What happened to money? Bill Horn, Bezdev. And you know what happens right now? I called FBI, I called them, and they're looking at that because it's not right you do it. You're calling right now his office number. 619-5155. He hides what he is, another name. That's what he does. You can't look anything, your Twitter or comment, anything that. That's why we have no bathrooms. There's nothing like that. All these things happen. The buses are changed 9-11, 9-6-8, 9-2-9, fixed. That's got, you know what happens right here? Everything's wrong here. You know, you give a free passes to the Chinese. They're not illegal, and they're in the housing too. That's what he does. They don't rent. He calls the owners and the managers and everything like that. That goes here. And right now, I bet MTS, union, if they leave, I bet you transit goes over there. You don't want jobs, and you don't want to pay everything. And also, transit, do you pay them to do the job? I don't know. That doesn't work. All these mad callers is gone for 20 years. You know, the supervisors have been here so long, they created the housing shortage because they didn't HUD milling. They didn't build anything for 20 years. So that's crap. That's what goes on here. Everything is wrong with this county and the city because this mad calling has been gone so long. You're afraid. You're scared. I don't know your collaborators. I'm resistance. I'm going to tell you everything. And I got friends in high places. And this is going to come out because the FBI is going to look at you and call you and invest everything in this county. It's so corrupt. Everything I look is bad. There's no maintenance. We change the bus stops. We change the bus stops. You do all these things. No bathrooms. The worst thing I ever heard of. It's the meanest thing I ever heard of.
Thank you, Ms. Walsh. Time is up. Next, Max Eldred, Maria Cortez, and Michelle Crew.
Good morning, Chair and MTS Board. So I'm Max Ellerin from Mid-City CAN, and one of our biggest campaigns, as you know, is a Youth Opportunity Pass, which is a no-cost transit passes for youth. And ultimately, what we want to do at Mid-City CAN is ensure that youth voices are heard with regards to transportation. Transportation is a big obstacle for a lot of our youth that are low-income in our community and City Heights. And so we're really pushing for this campaign. So our ask is in confirming the consultant for the MTS ballot measure in 2020 is that you do polling on student passes. We did a poll back in 2015, an FM3 poll, and it polled really high in 2015, and we definitely feel it will poll high again this year if you conduct it. So please definitely conduct that poll. Lastly, we believe MTS leadership, we have high hopes for leadership in doing this sort of community-based approach and outreach with the 2020 ballot measure. So we are excited, and please do conduct the polling for these passes. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Maria Cortez, and I'm a resident of City Heights for 45 years, also here with Mid-City CAN, the Youth Opportunity Bus Passes. I too am asking to support the poll, because you will find out by supporting this poll measure, you will find it will be very popular for the Youth Opportunity Bus Passes. It's going to be very, very popular, which will mean increasing in the ridership. And the more ridership that you get, the more money we're going to be making, the more people are going to be riding transit. You're going to see that enhancing transit, you're going to give our youth the opportunity to go to different jobs, the youth to also go to the after school activities, and it's going to increase their attendance. So I'm asking you on behalf of myself with Mid-City CAN to please take this ballot measure and in conducting the poll. And there is the lady that spoke before about transit, about the dogs being on there. I've seen a lot of dogs that are not service animals that are on there. They're snapping at kids. I too would like to see if maybe something can be done about that, but I would like to see the ballot measure be put on there for the poll. Thank you very much.
Good morning, Chair Georgette Gomez and the rest of the board. I'm Michelle Krug, and I am speaking specifically about the new routing for the 963. I spoke about it before June 10th with the scare and anticipation, and Sharon brought one of the planners down, but I just asked her, we don't remember exactly the name of the person, but she's going to check out who it was. And what I was told at that time was that It was the 963, which is being changed from the 962 to go into Paradise Hills, was going to be going out to Saipan and then turning around and coming back. That is not what actually happened, as I now had to use it. And what is happening is it became a loop. Two major issues are that it's starting, he also told me that it would not change the schedule at all, that I would be able to get it as early as I have gotten it in the past. That is not the case. The earliest one doesn't begin till 6:21 in the morning. It used to begin at 5:35 in the morning. I have to go to LA at least once a month and catch the Amtrak at 6:55 in the morning to even get there at 10:30 for a 10:30 meeting. So this is really critical, and I'm hoping that you might be able to at least push it so that it is an hour earlier. Even if it's just a bus that runs once an hour at that time. But there's a lot of people. Southeast San Diego and National City is what it affects, is really, you know, working families, and a lot of those people have to begin work at 6. So I'm kind of surprised if you haven't gotten other concerns about it. So if there's anything that you can do about starting it earlier, it would be highly appreciated. Also, as a loop, it does not come back to the same area, and it limits, again, how many, you know, where you can get on. I have to go east in order to come back west. That's less critical than starting first thing in the morning. So anything you could do, Myrtle, particularly, because it's your area, Georgette, David.
Your time is up.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Lorraine Layton, and then Clive Richard.
Good morning, Board. My name is Lorraine Layton, and I'm at 1034 North Magnolia Avenue, El Cajon, California. And this deals with the board and several of the routes. First off the bat, in El Cajon, you have a Route 15, A15 driver, a female, who enjoys discriminating against ADA and those that are disabled. One was already submitted in. The other one is in the process of being submitted in, because it got to the point to where, I'm not going to use the ramp for you. You can walk on. You're not disabled, okay? And this went on right after your shakeup, and it should be the date of June 30th on the 8:15. And I was trying to catch the bus so I can catch the 8:75, because the way you guys split it up and the way the buses are running out there to where you have to not only double track, but triple track to go back just to get to where you have to go. Number one. And it got into a really nasty conversation and recorded. Okay, number two, you have a Route 875 driver, male, which has been, as of last shakeup and before that, been reported. Nothing's been done about it. He sits there, feeds his mouth full of sunflower seeds. When you ask for the ramp, he doesn't do nothing. It's like you're dead last on the to get on. Or he'll sit there and look like, duh. Now, what the hell is going on with these drivers that you quote, what is it now? San Diego Transdev is what's on the paperwork. But yet, you have to walk a bus and a half length because they're so far back because they will not pull up to pick you up. Now, you want to figure out why? Good question. Then, there's only one good thing out of this whole mess. On the Route 30, you had an excellent driver who drove 351. Now, that is what you call a top driver. From the beach all the way to here.
One last sentence. Your time is up.
Okay, yeah, I will. And it will be going to ADA. And just for record, the 864 needs to move the how do you say, trash can from getting on instead of being loaded on the rocks. And there will be a class action.
Thank you, Mr. Richards.
Next. Chair Gomez, members of the board, my name is Clive Richard, and as I love telling people, I live in the second supervisory district of this county and the ninth council district of the city of San Diego. That's the chair's district. This morning, I want to tell you that I was in at Grossmont, and I was thinking, what actually is transit-oriented development? And I wondered, with the development at Grossmont, How many people that actually live in the development actually use the trolley? So the question for me is transit-oriented development simply close to a transit facility, or is it a motivator for usage of the transit facility? Those are two very different things. It's very much like seeing the sunrise or watching the sunset and realizing that's not what's happening. But it's, so the question is, what does transit development really result in? For 20 years, I've heard that if you build a development next to a trolley stop, people will use it. I can't say that I've seen any evidence of that, and I'm hoping that out of today or sometime in the near future, we'll actually be able to give me an answer so that I can tell people what is really happening. Thank you.
Thank you. So that concludes our public comment. We are moving to the consent item agenda. If I could get a motion, if there are any requests to pull any other items. Let's see. Thank you, Mayor Salas. Second by Mr. Hall. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Moves unanimously. We have no closed session today, so we're going to move into our discussion items. First item, Grantville Trolley Station, transit-oriented development. Perhaps that will answer the question that Mr. Clark was asking.
Good morning. While they're setting up for the presentation, I just wanted to preface this by saying that today's action is not to approve any kind of design or any kind of you know, support for the type of project. It's really asking this body for authorization to go into an exclusive negotiating position at this point. But we're going to give you a presentation on why we are suggesting this. This has been brought to the issues surrounding Grantville and potential joint development have been brought to the executive committee a couple times so far, and that's why they're bringing forward this recommendation to you today. I'll turn it over to Tim Allison now.
Good morning. We've been talking about the Grantville Trolley Station for a number of years, and the activity in development and construction has really increased over the past couple of years. And so one of the other efforts that were going on this property was that the city was going through a full redevelopment analysis and rezone, and that was completed in 2015. So I wanted to go over this property again just to refresh everybody's memory. We bought the property for the Mission Valley East extension. There is a 9.4 acre parcel. We've got 246 parking spaces plus overflow lots at this site. We've got 5 bus bays, and it was a federally funded acquisition. So this is a an overhead view of what the property looks like. You can see that we have in the center right is the paved parking area. You can see that there are dirt lots to the west of this and also to the north. You can see the viaduct that is on the very south end of the property with the elevated trolley station, and the bus bays are in this location. We've got another significant part of this property is the Alvarado Creek that runs to the on the very north and west side of the property. It is a tributary to the San Diego River. There has been significant flooding issues in this area over the years. It seems like every year the properties to the north of the channel are flooded out. a big part of the effort that the city had done over the past number of years is to come up with a design solution that hopefully will mitigate flooding and enhance the channel over time. So we brought the property to the executive committee in January. We had an unsolicited proposal from Affirmed Housing, and at the same time we had an unsolicited proposal from Graystar to develop the property. Affirmed Housing is an affordable housing developer, very well respected in the community, and Graystar is a national, international developer of multi-residential housing. Graystar, for example, has the property just to the northwest of us, the Ballpark Village project that everybody sees when they come into the into our building. So at the time, the executive committee, when we presented their proposal, we also indicated that we needed to do a separate analysis of the site from an economic standpoint to determine just what we can develop on the site. Kaiser Marston Associates were hired to do that study. We asked them to review updated land use, market research, financial feasibility analysis, including yield studies and residual land values on different scenarios for the site, and to recommend to MTS current development environment versus highest and best use. And the big part here is that the most dense zone in the city was overlaid on this site. It's a CC3-9 overlay, which allows for up to 109 dwelling units an acre. You can also achieve higher densities with different bonuses. So the concern that we've had is whether or not we can achieve that kind of density at this location. It is the hub for the Grantville area's transit node, but what we were seeing in the area was that no projects were coming forward that had that kind of density. So we wanted to come back to the executive committee with the study results and recommendations. I wanted to also show you this flood zone area that I discussed a little earlier. You can see in the light blue that this is the flood zone, the 100-year flood zone that impacts a portion of our north part of our property. So as part of the city's analysis, they came up with a planning study that was finished last summer. And I think I've mentioned that before to the executive committee, definitely, and to the board. What is being proposed in this area, you can see this slide is a look of what the improvements would be on the very northwest side of our project, of our property. The channel would be realigned. There would be a floodable green space. There would be trails, walking trails on both the north and the south sides. There would be some pedestrian access ways from the north to the south, so it has access to the property and to the transit station. The properties to the north would all have to be raised in elevation to get out of the flood zone. The community at this point supports this planning study that the city has done. I want to emphasize that that isn't a program project yet. It hadn't been seen by the city council. So it's a planning study that the city has as a framework for all of the developers in the area to utilize to be able to kind of plan how they want to do their projects. So during this time that Kaiser Marston was doing their analysis, we received a revised proposal, which was a partnership from Affirmed Housing and Graystar. I think that with all our discussions about what was going on with the area, they came back in with a proposal that would look at 185 units of affordable housing in combination with a market rate project that would be student housing. This was a massing study to kind of put some numbers to the site, what they were looking at as far as what they could actually finance, what they could actually build in the economic market. But it is below the 109 maximum dwelling units per acre that we can get on this site. And so when it was basically going in parallel to the study that Kaiser Marston was doing. This is a plan view of what the massing would look like for this kind of a project. It's basically a type 5 construction, which is stick built surrounding a standalone parking garage. The parking garage is in the center. You can see, though, that this study just shows buildings on the property, but it didn't take into account the fact that there was the channel work that would have to be done on the very west and the north side. So this study, this map would all have to be re-looked at if we get into negotiations with the development team. There are design criteria and environmental issues that would have to be looked at based on all the new overlays that were created by the city in their planning process that was approved a couple of years ago. So I wanted to present Paul Mara. He's the managing principal for Kaiser Marston and Associates, and he's going to go over the study results that they did for this site. It's a very good information that we could bring to the executive committee and now the board to be able to show you what kind of different yields could be achieved on the site for different types of construction scenarios. The one thing that the board needs is to kind of get an idea of what type of a project you can actually see on this property, as opposed to just a planning number that would just be out there. So I want to turn this over to Paul.
Thank you, Tim.
Discuss it.
Thank you, Chair Gomez and members of the board. Good morning. Paul Mara with Kaiser Marston Associates. And I'm going to provide a brief overview of our feasibility study. So as Tim described, we reviewed the Graystar and affirmed proposal. We tested a series of development prototypes that were 100% market rate. And then we also tested several mixed income scenarios. So I'm going to walk through our findings. So the first thing to understand about the site is the difference between the gross site area and the net usable site area. And the current estimates, the site is about 9.37 acres gross, and that's the figure that you would use to calculate the achievable density. So, for example, the maximum density of 109 units per acre is applied to 9.37, which means you could build 1,020 units on the property under the zoning before considering any density bonuses. However, if you subtract out the transit facilities, the viaduct, and the environmental area, which are the two places where the site touches the creek or jumps the creek, you're losing about 4.4 acres. So you have a little under 5 acres of usable site area. So even though you could develop 1,020 units under the zoning, you'd have to fit them within the 5 acres. So what we did is we developed a series of prototype project descriptions. And as you move from left to right on this chart, you go from lower density wood frame surface parking, that's the type 5 garden, prototype 1, all the way to the far right, higher density concrete building, structured parking, that's prototype 5, labeled type 1 podium. And just to describe how we came at this, in that last column, you see where it says 109 units per gross acre. So we defined a prototype that maximized the density, but then that translates to 205 units per net acre. And that's what we had to understand, what kind of physical building accommodates 200 units per usable acre. And we concluded that's a concrete building, a mid-rise, not doesn't have to be a high-rise. And on the far left, we started using units per net acre. We started with lower density surface parking at 25 to an acre, which we acknowledges probably an unlikely use on this property, but we just wanted to test as a baseline garden apartments. Jump to what we call a type 5 wrap, which is the above grade parking structure with apartments wrapping it, still wood frame, and we estimated that would be about 75 units per net acre. Then we jump to a type 5 wood over podium parking, about 100 units per net acre. And then prototype 4 went to type 3, which is a steel frame and wood building over podium, about 150 units per net acre. So these are representative examples. These columns can move left and right a little bit. They're not glued to these exact construction types, but we thought it was illustrative as we move from 3 stories to a range of 7 to 12 stories. Again, one of our key purposes is to test whether prototype 5 is feasible, because that maximizes the density. On top of this, we would need to replace, our understanding is we need to replace 120 commuter spaces on the property. So we ran a series of financial performas for these 5 scenarios, and we were solving for what's called residual land value or supportable land payment. So this is an estimate of what a developer would pay you if they were purchasing the site, and we realize you're more likely to ground lease the site. You would translate that one-time value into an annual ground rent. But the purpose here was to compare supportable land values for each of these prototypes. This slide is a little mysterious because you don't see any dollar figures. That's because we're in a public meeting and you're contemplating negotiating with a developer team or with other developers in the future. So we're going to speak to you in broad ranges. In general, land values in the greater Mission Valley to La Mesa area are in the $40 to $80 per foot for higher density multifamily zoning. But we're going to speak just in a general outcome. So what you see right away is that the highest land value was generated by prototype 2. So prototype 2 maximizes density before going to podium parking. It does the above grade parking structure and otherwise uses wood frame construction. That yielded the highest land value of our 5 scenarios. The prototype 1 garden apartments, we felt, generated a medium land value comparatively. When we jumped to prototype 3, where we got into a more urban building, still wood frame, but over podium parking, the land value dropped to what we call a low land value. And then in prototypes 4 and 5, where we're in steel and concrete, higher density, we had negative land values, meaning a developer would not be a feasible project for a developer to build. And we would say in the near to midterm, in the 5 to 10 year horizon, we would not envision you'll get proposals that are at that density. So we conclude that the 109 units per acre is not feasible in, for example, a 10-year planning horizon. Whatever your land value outcome, whatever scenario you're in, you still have the obligation to replace the commuter parking, and we anticipate that's an obligation imposed on the developer, but that eats into what they can pay for land. So, for example, 120 spaces at a potential cost of $30,000 per space, if it's structured parking, is a $3.6 million burden that would have to be carried by whichever scenario is being developed. And we did find that student housing generally adds a premium to the land value. Students pay higher rent for a more complicated building with more amenities, but it generally yields a slightly higher land value than just baseline conventional apartments. So then we also went on to test a series of mixed income scenarios. In the previous page, the developers of any of those projects would have to pay the city's inclusionary affordable housing fee. On this slide, we took the type 5 wrap prototype 2, which was the most feasible on the previous slide of the market rate scenarios, had the highest land value. And as we move across the page, we take more and more affordable units or deeper affordability. So this was just an illustrative test. If we took that market rate type 5 wrap product and then set aside 20% units at moderate income in the second column, or go further, 20% units at 65% area median income, or go all the way to 20% at very low. So you could test 10% or 30%. You could test whatever set aside you'd like to examine. We use these just as an illustration of the ability for the market rate land value to absorb the burden of the affordable units. In the third and fourth column, those projects would not have to pay the affordable housing fee because they have at least 10% at 65, which is the city's ordinance. So there, just to give you an example, our market rent assumption is about $2,400 per unit per month. The moderate rent, 20% of the units would be reduced to about $2,000 per unit per month, which is a small loss of rent. So you see our high land value drops to a medium land value in terms of the outcome for the value for the property. But when we go to the next column, we're taking 20% of the units, dropping them from 2,400 market rate to about 1,300 at 65% of median. So that's a much more significant loss. And that generates a low land value. We've erased almost all of the land value. And then in the final column, when we go to 20% at 50, units are being dropped from 2,400 market rent to about 963, just under 1,000 for those 20% set aside. And that generates a negative land value. So that would be beyond the reach of what a market rate developer could absorb into the project. We put that pink on the screen to show first that that one hit a negative land value, but also we believe in the third and fourth column, you don't have $3.6 million left over to build the replacement parking. So the land value in the 20% at 65 is already below $3.6 million. It's not enough to build the replacement parking that we're estimating 120 units at 30,000. So again, this was an example where it's essentially a market rate developer setting aside some units as affordable, not using other affordable housing programs. And so then we looked at a standalone tax credit apartment scenario. So obviously most affordable housing in our region is being built with tax credits, either the 9% tax credit or 4% tax credit plus tax exempt bonds and other funding sources. And in that case, if a portion of the property was being dedicated to 100% affordable, that developer would pursue these other funding sources, tax credits, other state or federal sources, and typically a local contribution, which in this case presumably would come from either the San Diego Housing Commission or Civic San Diego. And those gaps, those contributions from the local agency, have been running about $50,000 to $100,000 per unit. So this tax credit developer would chase all those funding sources, put together the package for that project, including getting that local contribution. That puts you into a dialogue with your sister agencies, because the City of San Diego through Housing Commission or Civic San Diego would have to be a contributor. And it's not uncommon that you might have to consider reducing the value of your property to make the transaction work. Effectively, this is what Graystar and Affirmed are doing, because they're dedicating a portion of the property to an affordable tax credit project and pursuing subsidy from the Housing Commission. I'll turn it back to you.
So, in essence, what we're, as Paul Meyer has indicated, what has been presented to us by the developers partnership is a standalone affordable housing unit plus a standalone student housing development. And the two of them together would be, 185 units of affordable housing has been suggested, as well as 240 units of student housing. I will note that with student housing, it's a lot more beds, so that comes to about 665 beds. But these numbers aren't really relevant to the discussion as much today, because what we would do is we would enter into a negotiation with the team. We would go to the board in the fall at our September meeting to discuss with you in closed session terms what you would like to see with the property in the event that we begin this negotiation after today. Really what we wanted to indicate with the presentation from Kaiser Marston is that the densities that we're looking at in the proposal that we've been given by the team are consistent with what we could reasonably expect to support on the site under current market conditions. That's not to say that 15 years from now the site wouldn't support something much larger, who knows, but this is what's before us today. We also know from the performers that have been given to us from the developer team that the returns are consistent with what the KMA analysis has shown us for the ranges. Go ahead. So based on that analysis, staff is recommending that we continue discussions with Affirmed and Graystar and that at this time that we are seeking authorization for the CEO to enter into exclusive negotiations with the affirmed Gray Star team.
I'd also like to add that we have representatives from Affirmed Housing, Mr. Jim Silverwood, and from Gray Star, Mr. Jerry Brand, are in the audience as well.
With that, I'll turn it over for questions.
Thank you for that presentation. We do have two requests, two slips to speak. I just want to note to the committee members that you do have a letter from Councilmember Sherman. This land does sit in his district, and we have a staff person here today. So I'm going to call her Liz St. Conning.
Good morning, everybody, and thank you very much for your time. First and foremost, we want to thank your staff, especially Mr. Allison, for all of his hard work on this project. He has been in every single stakeholder meeting for this region of Grantville, so we really appreciate your partnership with this. The council member is very pleased to see this item moving forward, and he's very supportive. It's very important that MTS enters into negotiations regarding this site. Something he does want to highlight for you is in 2015, the city approved the Grantville Focus Plan Amendment. As part of that, it's a goal to transform that area into a lively, walkable community adjacent to the Grantville Trolley Station. As Mr. Allison mentioned in the presentation, our big hindrance is the Alvarado Creek. We did provide as well some maps for you guys that shows the floodplain. It's actually on page 2. I believe everyone should have that. As you can see, this is the current Hundred-year floodplain as is. In 2016, the city applied for a smart growth incentive grant with SANDAG to come up with a preferred alternative to address this flooding. This area as a whole can hold up to 8,000 units. That's the very height. We know we're not going to go anywhere near that, but we want at least the potential there for the other property owners. What we are asking you guys today is to direct Gray Star and Affirmed Housing to work with the city, incorporate the supplemental design regulations in the Grantville Focus Plan Amendment, as well as incorporate the aspects of our Grantville Station Alvarado Creek Revitalization Study, which was presented into your plan. We have a lot of potential for this site. We want to increase access to this trolley. It's a wonderful resource for our community. So thank you very much.
Thank you for that. Up next, Danielle Smith.
Good morning, Madam Chair, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Dan Smith, and it turns out 1995 I started getting involved with this property. I didn't know that I'd be one of your neighbors these years later. As testified, we've been trying to get the focus plan amendment for these properties in Grantville. It finally took place in 2015. It took us 15 years. And now, after some more years, we finally have this Alvarado Creek restoration plan done by Lisa Lynn. And it's been very well received by Regional Water Quality Control Board, all the neighbors. And we've had many, many, many developers over the years wanting to develop these sites. It's a wonderful property, but it's got all the problems you can imagine. First of all, today it's a real dump. You have a car auction on Mission Gorge Road. You got graffiti all over the creek. I mean, it's a real big mess. Take a look and you'll see what I'm talking about. But what's important, now we have all things going our way. We have the economy, we've got developers, we have the restoration plan, and we even have the Alvarado Canyon Road extension coming soon, as the council office probably knows. So the Alvarado Canyon Road extension is going to take part of both your parcels on one of those maps along Mission Gorge Road. That's important to know because the restoration project has to have a box culvert under Mission Gorge Road fixed. And stormwater, we met with stormwater, so forth. You've got a box culvert that's affecting the flow of the water. You got a new road going right there. So you've got all these complicated problems that need to be addressed. So it's really exciting, the fact that you're finally hearing this after all these years of Tim's work and our work. In general, the Navajo Planning Group, of which I've been on a member for, I think, 35 years, we are certainly excited about development of the site. We'd like it to go by our guidelines. We're all having to put walkways on both sides of this creek, including myself. I'm going to develop my share, casters. We're all into this thing. So we appreciate your support. and we look forward to working with you.
Thank you. Before I open it up to the committee members, I just... What's underneath the other one? Maya Rosas.
Thank you. I'll try to be brief. Of course, my name's Maya Rosas. I'm a Circulate San Diego. Good morning. We are supportive of this moving forward, really super excited to see it coming under development at Grantville. Seeing as this is in the early stages of this all coming together and the proposal being put together in detail, I wanted to ask that we dive a little bit deeper in our analysis of the parking that's provided, both for the project itself, for the affordable, for the student, but also for the replacement parking. Of course, it impacts your bottom line as an agency. It also impacts the potential for ridership. Of course, with more parking, that just induces the demand for people to come and drive and drive there instead of taking transit for the residents. And it is very relevant to the City of San Diego being able to accomplish its climate action plan goals as well. As you all know, we released a report called Real Opportunity a few months ago, and so I just wanted to quickly rehash that what we are asking for in that report is that in the future, with an update to your policy on joint development, that you include affordability as a requirement for development projects. Of course, this one has it, and that's fantastic. Also, that when you look at into joint developments, you reduce the parking, the replacement parking required, and importantly, proactively solicit proposals. As you saw with this proposal, you got two proposals at the same time. They combined and became a better product. Of course, if you solicit proposals, that will create more competition, more people coming in, and you'll be able to get the best deal for your agency and for the community. So I look forward to seeing these improvements to your policy. I look forward to seeing this proposal coming forward and being developed. And thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. And before I open it up to my committee members, I don't know if the either developers would want to say anything to the board, give you an opportunity.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the board. I'm Jim Silverwood, the president and CEO of Affirmed Housing. We've been developing affordable housing here in San Diego for more than 25 years, and as I look around the room in many of the jurisdictions here that you have representatives from. We're really excited about this proposal. We believe that when we made an adjustment to our proposal and partnering with Graystar, you have a great blend of affordable housing and then the student housing. We think it's going to increase ridership for the transit service and obviously provide much needed affordable housing. In regard to the comments from Councilman Sherman's office, I would just apologize because we're very proactive in reaching out and talking to the council offices, but we hadn't gone to Councilman Sherman yet because this really, if the board approves this ENA today, that would be our next step. So it was a little premature to reach out to the councilman's office. One last thing I would say, and then I'll introduce Jerry Brand from Graystar, is that as far as the creek improvements, we actually own a property directly adjacent to this site right now. We're redeveloping for veterans housing, 85 units for veterans. So we're very familiar with the creek. We negotiated with city staff on the environmental staff and the creek improvements. We're developing a walking trail adjacent to our project. So we're going to definitely be getting with city staff here down the road to make sure that we adhere to the plan for the creek improvements, and I'm sure it'll be a wonderful effort. With that, I'd like to introduce Jerry Brand from Graystar. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I appreciate very much the opportunity to hopefully find ourselves negotiating with MTS. I will simply say this. I think it's wonderful that you had the Kaiser study done first, and without, you know, our set of numbers and underwriting having come to the same conclusion as that of Kaiser. And I think that's a great process for the city, as opposed to the developer advocating as to what works best. But I would just simply say, Ben, Graystar is very active in student housing. We recently went public with notification that we're buying a large student housing company. And we're very excited about that. We already are active in student housing and student housing management, but this will expand our capabilities. And to Jim's point, I think the opportunity for ridership and the question raised by the gentleman earlier, how does transit-oriented development really influence ridership? It's clear to us that the students will be highly motivated to board the train and go one stop to campus. So thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you.
Yes.
So with that, I'll open it up to committee members. If there are any questions? Mr. Alvarez.
Thank you for the presentation, and I concur with the comment that it's nice to have Kaiser Marston or anybody really do analysis prior to entering to negotiations just to see where people fall. Their proposal versus information that we have on the inside. I'll start with my colleague, Mr. Sherman's letter. I want to acknowledge the work that's been done in Grantville, and I highly suggest, and I have faith and affirm because of their track record, that there will be work being done around the Grantville Station Alvarado Creek revitalization study. Those studies, you know, the city council offices often work really hard to get funding to get those done. The community goes through a pretty extensive process to provide their input, and so I think it's going to be really critical that gets incorporated, and I have no concerns. I think that will happen. I don't know Graystar, but I do know Affirmed, and I'm sure that will be the case. So I just want to note that to the staff as this moves forward. I agree with that suggestion. Now, to the presentation, I'm going to focus on three slides. Maybe the first one would be slide number 11. And are we, so the prototype number 5 gets us the most number of units. It builds out to the available and to the city approved density. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay. And understanding that not all of the property here can be built up to that density because of the creek, the river, the different things that need to get built into that, what on the space that is available to build housing, how much could you actually build? And you had a slide with the 4 acres, mm-hmm. you know, because of the 9 minus the 5. So how much could you have actually have built if everything went great and you built to the top number of density allowed in the city approved plan? Is that the 1,020 here?
Board Member Alvarez, if you're asking applying the allowable density only to the net area as
yes.
just a method of estimating, you basically would have 5 acres times 109, so you'd be about 550 units.
Okay. On the next slide, what are we parked at for these scenarios?
On the slide, or?
Are you at the minimum parking standard from the city code, or are you at a market driven anticipated demand for parking approach?
Pardon my delay. So across these scenarios, the code is 1.25 per one bedroom, 1.75 per two bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
And for our assumed unit mix of ones and twos, the weighted average is 1.55. We used 1.55 in prototypes 1 and 2, but then we deviated from that because we felt that that was a very high parking ratio, and there's many initiatives in the city to, you know, to reduce parking requirements.
Right.
So on scenario prototype 3, we used 1.4. Prototype 4, we used 1.3. And prototype 5, we used 1.25. And there, all of these are a mix of 1 and 2 bedroom is our assumed mix.
So you went to the minimum standard in prototype 1 and 2,
yep.
But hope that the city quickly gets to parking reductions, as I do I. And you use that as the base. Okay.
Right.
Below that, at the 120 commuter parking spaces, are those all used? I know you said you were required to keep those or to use this as part of the calculation. What's the utilization rate on that?
Well, right now we have about 200, over 200 and I think it was 240 or 260, the actual paved parking spaces that we have there today. We probably don't park anything more than about 70 to 80.
Okay.
That we've been doing counts for a number of years. Also, the affirmed housing had one of the engineering companies around town do a parking study as well, and so the need for parking is a lot less than what's actually out there today. Plus, we have all those overflow parking lots that. Right. When we had Charger games or whatever, they were full, but that was only X number of days per year. So in going further with a project, we would be doing a very specific analysis of what the parking reduction can be for commuters to be able to handle what our demand is today versus what we feel is growth. That's what we did with the AmCal project, where we had probably about 180 spaces, and we wound up with 100 spaces that allowed us for our existing demand plus growth, but we reduced it. And so going further, we would definitely look at doing a very significant study to see where we can end up with the number of parking spaces.
Okay, I'm going to follow up on that. If you go to the next slide, the negative land value, both on this slide and the previous slide, what you're referring to is that if the developer is required to replace the 120 parking spaces, they would fall under negative land value, or we would be at the negative land value. What is that?
If I might back up one slide first, and let me answer it there. Yep. No.
Nope.
The other direction. I don't have slide numbers. One back. Yeah. Okay. Pardon me. So I'll start on this slide and then answer the question
yes.
on the next slide as well. So the if you had an arrangement with a developer where they were building either prototype 4 or prototype 5, even before considering the cost of the replacement parking, they would have an infeasible project. You know, you would have to pay them to build the project, right? You would get no land payment, the project would require a subsidy, and then on top of that, they presumably are the ones building the replacement parking. Someone has to come up with the cost of that replacement parking, so that's a further negative in those two columns.
Mm-hmm.
On the next slide, when before considering the replacement parking,
I actually get it. You don't have.
Okay.
You don't need to.
Okay.
Just to save time. So I would be interested in understanding how we could move. Always in my mind is building more units, and so how we can move into more units regardless of the prototype you use. But at what point, if you start reducing at the cost of $30,000 per space, every one of those parking spaces, do they move from negative land value to potentially positive land value of some amount? And obviously all that is part of the fiscal considerations that they need to make, whether the deal is good for them or not, right? But that would be sort of my, and I would probably want to underscore that in all likelihood, and I cannot speak for the rest of my colleagues in the council or for the mayor, but we will be moving, I really hope, into when we are building developments this close, especially on transit. This is not even close to transit. This is on transit. We will significantly reduce parking requirements at the city. Till the December 10th, which is the day I leave, I will be asking and pushing for that. And I think that we have a really good consensus around that idea at the city. So there could be movement in the positive versus negative land value valuation, is what I would say. Lastly, because I've taken up so much time, is this going to be a mixed-use development or exclusive residential development?
Well, the proposal before you would be that they've presented to us is just residential.
Okay.
With the amenities that the student housing would require as
right.
well. But that is obviously something that we could negotiate as well.
So. No, I'm just wondering because we are building a lot of mixed use with underutilized commercial space at the bottom, and I wouldn't want to put them in that position. And I wasn't sure what zone it was, neighborhood commercial or community commercial, and they each require different things. So. Now, really, lastly, the affordable housing slide on 14. Do both scenarios need to occur, the tax-exempt bond financing or the tax credit allocation from TCAC and the local assistance in order to meet the affordability requirement, or are you saying one of the two can occur?
I'm not sure what you're referring
to.
So
you've listed the federal funding, state funding sources,
oh,
which are the tax credit allocations.
Yes.
And then the Housing Commission has money on top of that or vouchers.
Correct.
Do they both need to occur in order for this to pencil out for them?
Okay. Yes.
All right. Okay. Thank you.
All right. Having some technical difficulties. Thank you for that. Councilmember Donovan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a question on the proposals received from Affirmed Housing and Great Star in January. Were those the result of an open solicitation, or were those unsolicited offerings for this project?
Unsolicited.
Unsolicited? Are we okay going forward with a non-competitive bid on this project?
I mean, legally we're allowed to, but that's one of the things that's, you know, before the board is that given. And I guess I would say it was unsolicited in the sense that we didn't have a formal RFP out on the street, but we have made developers aware that those property are now available for development. We just hadn't gone into that formal stage before we got these two offers. But legally, there's no prohibition on the board moving forward. That would be part of the decision today to authorize staff to move into exclusive negotiations.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for that. Councilmember Hall?
Yeah, mine's going to be real fast and easy. These fixes to the channel that they're talking about, is that going to take it out of the flood zone?
The idea is to put all of the flood zone area into the project area that I showed you on the
right.
slide.
I see that.
that's the goal. If the developers on the north side of the creek raise their pads, we do the widening on the south side. There's the floodable area that should.
So the 100 year won't matter anymore, and will a 500 year matter?
I don't know if Rick Engineering, who did the study, looked at a 500 year term. I'd have to look at it a little bit closer, but it was 100 year, I think, is their threshold.
So the 100 year world, we won't have any flooding, period, right?
That's what they're telling us.
Okay, and so we're not going to be seeing them carrying them in like boats like they do at the hotel down in Mission Valley?
Knock on wood.
All right.
We'll use some kayaks. Councilmember Saff.
Thank you. I just want to, let's see, be clear on the, none of this works without the creek plan happening, right? And that was that we spent $400,000 on that study, and we have the preferred alternative. I guess I'm just not clear if 100% this creek plan will be accommodated in the solicitations that we have. I sounded like it, but I'm not exactly clear because this creek plan has to happen for this to work.
Well, what we have to do on our side is to be able to accommodate the design thresholds and the overlay of the area that the project would have to happen in. We're on the very south side. We have pads that is out of the work zone for the channel rehabilitation. So when we do our negotiations with the developers, we would be looking at designing a project that would leave that envelope open for the project. And when the project actually moves forward, it's unclear of how it's going to be, what kind of participation there's going to be with the different property owners in the area, what kind of participation there will be with any public monies that would happen, if any. So as long as we use that envelope to be able to design our portion, we will be participating in any of the work that was going on with the project goes forward. And I don't know if that answers your question.
Let me make it clear. It's our property does not need the channel to be built, because our property does not, it's not, other than that section that we're talking about setting aside as part of this development, that's the portion of it that we need to do in order to accommodate the plan that the city has.
So Sandag, I'm in the wrong committee room. So MTS, you're gonna fix part of it so that you can accommodate the I don't understand this, like, I'm sorry, the envelope and all that stuff. I just needed a little bit more lay term what you're talking about, because this whole flooding and the creek plan, and we have all this, we have a Grantville plan that took 10 years. You know, we want to have as much, like Mr. Alvarez says, accommodate as much housing as we can in an area that it's, great for, and right there at the trolley station. So I'm just a little unclear if this whole creek plan is going to get done, or now you're saying maybe just a portion for the part that this housing development would be.
Yeah, but for our purposes on our land, it's not so much that we would be developing this sort of, they have like a box culvert, and I wish I had the cross section for you, but there's like there is a project that the city would undergo, but that's much more up in the areas off of our property.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we're still working with the city and the community plan and all of that stuff. So, you know, this is would have to all be worked out, but I just can't see anybody voting to move forward with this without that whole flooding and creek plan and everything as part of the overall plan. The other question I had was, I'm a little confused on the student housing. Would this be part, like, SDSU student housing, or housing for SDSU, or just students in general?
As it's been presented to us, it's not specific to San Diego State. So if as it's presented, it would be a student housing project. They would have to show that they were a student for maybe USD, maybe even UCSD. But right now, it's not. There isn't a specific negotiation with San Diego State.
Okay, I just didn't know how that worked, because I mean, literally, it's one stop from San Diego State. So it seemed like reasonable, since I have a daughter at San Diego State, and we were panicking about trying to find a place for her because there's no place, and she got stuck paying a huge amount of money for a small little room in some house, that it would be reasonable for San Diego State to be part of, a student housing development that they're actually getting the benefit of. So just a thought on that. Anyway, I'm not sure what to do on this one. The other thing I think the plan needs, by the way, I think walkable bridges across the creek, really important to increase ridership. So whatever plan happens, I think you need some of these walkable bridges to go across the creek as well. So anyway, just comments.
Maybe I can clarify.
Is it coming back to us?
Yeah, I think to answer the last thing, I think there are some planned walkable bridges. But the reality of this project, our project can go forward without anything from the city happening. We're going to make sure that the project is out of the floodplain. And then we're not going to develop in the area that is planned for the improvements to the drainage channel. So if and when the city, or however it comes together, builds that, the envelope, as it said, or the land, is there to do that. Doesn't have any impact on us. It'll look prettier, presumably, okay, but the channel is there. It's existed for a long time. I don't think we've ever been flooded there on our parking lot. We're above it. If you look to the north, that land is lower. If they wanted to develop that without this project being done, They do have to raise it up, but we don't, we're not there. So we, this is not contingent on the city's plan for this channel going forward.
And I just wanted to clarify, because I think there was a little bit confusion about what you're being asked to do today, because I want it to be clear, you're not approving this project or anything like that. What you would be authorizing is for staff to enter into exclusive negotiations with Affirmed and Graystar to engage in further negotiations, both about the scope of the project, what it looks like, to develop that, to bring back for further review, and then also on the price and terms and payment matter. Like,
and understand in this process, the developers and we want this step to be taken, so they have the assurance that they have exclusivity here, so they can start to spend money to develop further plans. And without that, I mean, they've done some plans here, but, you know, we have site plans. We don't have renderings. You know, they're going to have to look at that. They're going to have to look more at the floodplain and working with the city. So what this allows them to do is really start to spend money to develop this plan to the point where everybody's comfortable with it. We are, from a design standpoint, from a density standpoint. They get their financing. It all comes together, both the affordable and the student side. I mean, we want to look at things like transit passes. We're going to look at the parking requirements. We're going to look at all that stuff. And we'll be working, you know, initially through the executive committee for price and terms, and then ultimately to the board.
Okay. Councilmember Breland.
Well, and again, I understand that. I just, you know, we had Castle Rock approved by the city of San Diego, and they put this nice big 50-foot hill up, and all that hillside was coming down into Santee. So, there's a whole story on that. But the reality is it's a, you know, if they do build up the hill, we may get flooded because they build up the hill if they don't have the channel there. So, that's
well,
just some.
There's a channel there, and we've been maintaining it since we built Mission Valley, I think it's since we bought the property, right? Yeah.
Councilmember Freeland?
On page 13, where you kind of drill down on the Type 5 wrap option, the proposal that we've received so far, the joint proposal, where does that let me ask you this. Can you quantify when you say high land value versus medium land value, in rough terms, what the definition of high and medium is?
Yes, so the Type 5 wrap is. Excuse me. The Type 5 wrap is similar to what Graystar and Affirmed are proposing. They're actually in Type 3, but with a standalone garage, effectively a wrap product. High land value would be toward the upper end of the $40 to $80 range, mm-hmm. that I described as being typical in Greater Mission Valley, Eastern Mission Valley, and medium land value would be toward the lower end of that range. Low land value would be between 0 and 40.
All right. So what I was wanting to quantify is, at this point, this agency would be making a contribution towards the affordable housing component of the project. And I was wanting to quantify that contribution. I think the argument can be, we all recognize the need for housing, and we can all, at this chair or other chairs, try to do what we can to address that. As we sit here, though, our obligation is to transit. So if, in fact, by approving this program, it does include affordable component, I was wanting to be able to assign some, to quantify what that contribution is. I think if we're going to do that, I think we should be aware of the amount of money that we're kind of leaving on the table by not doing a market rate project.
And those would be things that we would discuss in closed session when we come back to the board, assuming that the board authorizes us into enter into price and terms of payment and exclusive negotiations.
We will quantify that.
But Board Member Mullen, you are correct that between the market rate column and the affordable columns, we have behind this PowerPoint slide, we have the pro formas that show the dollar differential. So we can easily bring you that number. What is the dollar cost of foregone ground rent, foregone land value that you've left behind in exchange for the set aside of affordable units. So we can share all that math with you. We didn't think that was appropriate since you're about to enter negotiations with the developer to discuss that in the open meeting.
The only reason I would argue that it is appropriate is that because the agreement we're considering does include an affordable component. So it, if it's a decision, and again, I understand the momentum, I understand the pressure to try to produce housing, but I still believe that this board should know what kind of transit money we will be spending to support housing. That's really the question in my mind.
Understood.
And to but, me, it's part of the component of this decision,
yeah.
Unless I'm missing something.
Well, it's going to take longer than a month and a half to come to a final agreement. So what I would suggest is that we schedule a closed session for our September board meeting, and we'll give you that information in closed session, but we can proceed today and start to negotiate.
Councilmember Diaz?
Yeah, I'd like to tie back to Councilmember Alvarez's comments. So I see in that page 13 that it's 20% moderate, 20% very low. And if I remember reading my materials, it's 4- and 5-story buildings. Is that what we're talking about in this project? Did I read that correctly? Let me just ask my question. So,
okay.
So going back to building more, have you folks looked at increasing or seeking greater bonus densities to make the project work where you can build more?
Can I go back 2 slides?
Yeah.
To the original prototypes?
Yeah.
Board Member Diaz, the concern there is we already in prototype 5 on this slide, we're using the maximum density allowed under the zoning, and it's causing us to go into concrete mid-rise buildings that are not feasible. And so if we add more density, if some of these units are affordable, we would be eligible for a density bonus. And then we have even greater density, and we're still in concrete, but we're in taller, more dense buildings, so it's a greater feasibility challenge.
Okay, thank you.
And the site would, with all the density bonuses allowable, could do 1,355 units, but with the caveats that you just heard.
I think in terms of lowering price, and it's probably looking really closely at the parking requirements that will save the money that will add to the bottom line of this project. And other than, we don't need more density.
So I do not have.
But that would reduce the 120 spaces that you're looking at? I mean.
No, it would reduce the amount associated with the housing project at the 1.54 down to 1.25. So, Jerry, what was the number for this 240?
340 for a student. 340? We got 340 for a student, but I think we have, again, 3 student beds in each apartment, so you can see.
There's at least 500 spaces, I think.
It's 547 stalls based on the conceptual.
Yeah. So it's looking at that every space worth $30,000 that potentially can be looked at. I mean, there is a balance between, you know, zero that we could do with transit passes and what makes a project attractive from a market standpoint, because some people will have cars. So
thank you. With that, I'm willing to offer this to have staff continue discussions and enter ENA with them. Affirming based on.
I'll second.
Thank you, Mr. Diaz. So we do have a motion to allow staff to enter into an exclusive negotiation. We will bring it back to the board and have a closed session to have further discussions on the details. It has been seconded by Councilmember Guy. Councilmember Saf, you have a question on the motion?
No, I was going to second it, but okay. Just a quick question. You know, we're talking about parking and we're talking about really wanting people to have to ride transit, the less parking we have, the more people that will live there that don't need cars, is what I'm thinking. Because the other one, affordable mixed use, or what do you call it, transit-oriented development, hardly any, we have so much parking there, not that many people are using it. So I think we could have far less parking. And the last question, did San Diego State ever approach or about student housing? Because I heard they were looking to build more student housing really close to the campus. Did they ever approach us, MTS?
I had some discussions with them several years ago, and they never wanted to pursue it.
Okay, just curious about that. I mean, my daughter does not have a car. She rides the trolley, and I just think if you have a lot of student housing and low-income housing and fewer parking spots, that we would attract those people that don't need to ride their cars. She does a lot of Uber and Lyft, I'll tell you.
Yeah. All right, well, this would be an excellent location for it. Yeah. One stop.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. We do have a motion, it's been second. So before I post the question, I'm definitely supportive of entering into an exclusive negotiation. There's a lot of details still to be worked on. I've said that I am interested in trying to maximize units in this. There's a great opportunity here. There is, if done correctly and negotiating correctly, there is an opportunity to increase our ridership. Super supportive of exploring the parking reductions. I think that's going to be at the City of San Diego side of things. So for us that are at the City of San Diego, we should be advocating for that. Definitely want to acknowledge Councilmember Sherman's letter in ensuring that regardless of this is more for the developers, the more that you can incorporate the revitalization of the creek and enhancing it would be very beneficial if we are thinking about also doing our part in trying to reduce some of the parking and trying to support this. So with that, I'm going to call the question. All those in favor, please say aye. Opposed? Moves unanimously. Thank you. Thank you for that great discussion. Very exciting. Moving forward to item 31, planning consultant for potential ballot measure. We have a contract award.
So while we're setting up and the room's clearing from the previous agenda item, I'll just kind of set the stage for this next agenda item. So we're bringing this recommendation for a contract award for a planning consultant to you after vetting it with the ad hoc ballot measure committee, as well as with our executive committee of the board. You know, this whole process putting forward a ballot measure is kind of uncharted territory for MTS. We're going to need consulting services to assist us with a lot of this. Long-range planning is really handled at SANDAG with our assistance, obviously. So we're really looking to try to maximize what's already been done in the region with the long-range planning, as well as kind of putting our own stamp on it through our transit optimization plan and other types of things that we've done. And so staff is bringing forward a recommendation to move forward with a contract with the consultant we use for our transit optimization plan. And this, we're going to kind of detail what kind of their expertise is, as well as kind of why we want to do this as a sole source. This is just one aspect of the whole planning for a ballot measure. There's multiple different consultants that we're trying to bring on board, whether it's for stakeholder and public outreach and involvement, for political consulting and polling assistance, These are all legal expertise, things like that. This is just one component of the larger effort that we're doing in, you know, pursuing whether or not we want to move forward with a ballot initiative. So I'll turn it to Dennis now to present.
Good morning. Thank you, Sharon. To my right is Russ Chisholm, who's the president of Transportation Management and Design. Sharon mentioned we're recommending a sole source award to TMD. And one of the primary reasons for that is because we did engage TMD in the transit optimization plan, which is just wrapping up now, started about 2 years ago. When we began that TOP in 2016, we really started two parallel tracks. One was a significant outreach effort led by our staff internally, and the other track was TMD doing a substantial amount of work on data collection, looking at markets, where markets are going, where markets are, what markets were missing, looking at different plans, community plans, the SANDAG coordinated plan, SANDAG RTP, looking at demographics, where are different populations living, where transit friendly populations living now, where are they going to be living in 5 or 10 years. So they've done a substantial amount of this work already. So one of the reasons we're recommending this sole source is not only because of TMD's expertise in this area, but also because they've already done a lot of this work. So it really gives us a good head start. We have a very short time frame for this project, and this will really benefit us getting this done in time to continue with the work on the ballot measure. TMD has a lot of experience doing this, not only in San Diego. They've obviously worked not only on the TOP, but also they were our consultant for the COA 10 years ago. But they've also done this around the country. Most recently, they've been doing work for a couple of properties in Texas. They've been working in the LA area, the San Francisco area, Florida. And Russ is available to speak to some of those. If you have questions afterwards, he can provide you more detail on the kinds of work that they're doing there. But that's really going to be the primary, task one of this contract, is really looking at the market review and the data collection that they kicked off with the TOP. The second task of this contract is to develop a program of transit projects. We don't have in this contract outreach for TMD like the TOP where we did that in-house. We have a separate track that's going to be doing the outreach and the surveying and the polling for this measure. But there's going to be a constant feedback loop with those because all that information needs to be fed into the program of projects that we'll develop with TMD. We'll be looking at consistency with the RTP, which is actually undergoing revision right now for a 2019. Edition of that. We'll be looking at how we can attract new riders. We're interested obviously in improving service for existing riders but also attracting new riders. We want to expand our frequent service network. We've been very, very successful in growing our ridership and growing our core network by providing 15 minutes or better frequency on very core services. We'd like to expand that. And we're also going to be looking at new service types not currently in use in the region. So the RTP actually has several of these, including skyways and streetcars and that kind of thing. So we'll be looking at those as well. And then a really hot topic right now is how all of this dovetails into emerging technologies like autonomous vehicles and zero emission vehicles. So tasks 3, 4, and 5 will all support the program of projects. Task 3 is to come up with some ridership estimates. These are going to be very high-level estimates on these because some of these look out very far into the future, and also because most of these projects are going to be interdependent on them, so it's going to be difficult to come up with one estimate for a single project without looking at the entire network. But we will have some high-level ridership estimates to ensure that projects we're proposing for the program of projects do have some benefit in terms of ridership. Task 4 is to look at the capital and infrastructure needed. This is very, very critical for us. If we were to receive $100 million to add service today, we wouldn't be able to do that because we don't have the vehicles or the facilities or the other support infrastructure that we need. So we need to get a handle on what all of those are going to need to be for the program of projects. So additional buses, trolley cars, transit centers. Most of our large transit centers are at capacity right now. So what does that mean for adding new service and how we accommodate that? And facilities, bus and rail maintenance and storage facilities. All of these are going to be very critical in how this this rolls out. And the last task that we're going to engage them in is operating cost estimates. So these will be cost estimates for each of the projects in the program. So with that, the recommendation for you today is to authorize the CEO to execute the contract with TMD for the planning services for the ballot measure, and this contract would run through June of 2019. However, we expect the bulk of the work to be completed by the end of this year, but we'd keep the contract open through June for any follow-up work that we'd need from TMD. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Dennis. We do have one speaker request, Ms. Maya Rosas.
Good morning again. Maya Rosas with Circulate San Diego. Thank you for being here today. And we are extremely supportive and excited to see this moving forward. Of course, the San Diego region needs new transportation funding, and so we want to support in any way possible. Circulate is currently doing some research and analysis on ballot measures in support of a 2020 ballot measure. We are looking into revenue and a possible expenditure plan and possible key signature projects. Importantly, we are doing an analysis of polling that has been done on previous ballot measures across the state and whether or not those ballot measures were successful. And so we will be coming back to share that with you once that analysis is complete and hope to be able to support this effort moving forward. But just to put it out there for you all, we believe that items like rail as a signature project, something as simple as pothole repair, and safe routes to school poll very well and will be very popular when this comes to a vote, of course, assuming you need 66% to pass. But we also are highly supportive of increasing service for successful bus lines and converting them to rapid as much as possible. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Ms. Rosas. Mr. Hall.
You will do polling just to make sure this thing, if it's crashing and burning, we're not spending any more money on it. You will do enough polling where if it doesn't go through, I guess
you
need the proper terminology. Okay.
No, we're in the midst of a procurement right now for political consulting services, which would include polling and focus groups.
All right, thank you. I'll move to approve.
Thank you, Mr. Hall. Councilmember Donovan.
Thank you. I just wanted to ask if, are there any other funding sources identified for these projects and than raising the tax? I wonder, it might be an unfair question because we're not sure what the projects are, but my feeling is we know sort of what kind of projects we want to pursue, and it seems like we've jumped right to a sales tax increase, and I was just wondering if there's other potential funding sources for these kind of projects.
There is. Would it be of sufficient to expand out the system and build things like the Purple Line, et cetera, without this? No. But as we go through this process, and especially after we get a program of projects, we will go through and bring to the board for a decision on a finance plan. And that finance plan will, one of the elements to it will be to decide how much outside money should be with sales tax money in order to do the project. For example, I think the standard at Sandag for Transnet was one outside dollar for one inside dollar. And I think actually at some point that got to three outside dollars for one outside dollar. And if you look at the Blue Line project or the trolley renewal, I think we were about that. we got three outside dollars for everyone. It was about a $750 million project, and I don't even know if we used $200 million of Transnet because we had Prop 1A and Prop 1B and ARRA money and a whole bunch of other things. So one of the key decisions that the board will make as we get into a finance plan for these projects is how much outside money we should rely on in order to create the finance plan. So that will all come to you.
Okay, I guess I just, as a comment, I think it's kind of high risk to think we're gonna get 2/3 vote on another tax increase based on recent history. So that's just a comment. Thank you.
Well, and that's the political consultant that we're looking at now that we've already done a solicitation for, so it's gonna be a competitive bid. That we should have that in September, I'm hoping. And one of the early things in our discussions with them is to do some early on polling to gauge the temperature of this. So also, I mean, that'll also be coming to the board for discussion and where we go in the future.
Fair enough, thank you.
Thank you. Supervisor Cox.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this is a good starting point. I think that clearly there is a need for more transportation improvements. Obviously, as we look back at Proposition A, that obviously was not successful. There's a lot of reasons for that, but I know that there's already a lot of projects that were going to be anticipated to be funded as a result of Proposition A had that passed. So I imagine that's kind of a starting point. I certainly hope that the Purple Line is going to be one of those things that will be evaluated as a part of this. And I guess I would be remiss if I didn't acknowledge I know there's a few people in this room that have been working on the Bayshore Bikeway for a good number of years. I think that there is an opportunity also to take a look at, as this is being evaluated, perhaps bicycle improvements that would be tied into the transportation system that we already have. The Bayshore Bikeway, we're pretty far along with it. And there's a few remaining sections, and I think most of those sections are either very close to the existing trolley line. So I would hope that would be something, as was mentioned by one of the speakers, that we look at not just the direct transit related projects, but those that would be contributory to people using the transportation or transit system. Thank you.
Councilmember Alvarez.
Thank you. I appreciate the inclusion of the contract in today's backup. That's very helpful. One of the sections under the scope of work that I would request we somehow modify is this presentations to the under project support, scope of work, project support, presentation to up to 3 MTS board or executive committee meetings. I think that's a little low. Is this over the course of the entirety of the contract or on an, I assume so, it doesn't say on an annual basis, so.
So what we put in there was, this was the scope of work that we put out to get an estimate from the consultant. And so it's a not to exceed amount. We can, if we need to tweak it to allow for more presentations to the board, et cetera, then we will do that. This does not preclude us from going to the board 10 times if we need to.
Right. I think in general, just presentations are going to be required in far more substantial number as we attempt to be very transparent and public with this whole process. And so I'm concerned with what each additional presentation is going to cost in terms of above and beyond the current contracted amount.
And we will have, we also have civilian, which the board authorized their contract. They'll be doing a lot of the presentations, outreach, talking with stakeholders, going to the community. That's really a separate function. This would be more, you know, if Russ himself is going to be sitting in front of you giving a presentation on planning principles or something like that. It wouldn't necessarily be as much about him presenting to community members or stakeholders and things like that.
Okay.
But duly noted, we definitely will be.
Yeah, because this is over the course of the next probably at least 2 years, we'll be calling upon potentially their services.
Well, only until June 30th of 2019.
Okay, so only a year.
Yeah, and we anticipate most of their work will be done by the end of this calendar
right.
year.
Right. Okay.
I would look at the process sure. similar to the TOP.
Yeah.
Where Russ's organization, you know, we do, you know, and it should also be said that he did the original COA for us, for board members. Mm-hmm. How many were here in 2004 and 2005, but so he's had a long history. But we do this in combination with our planning staff and Dennis's group so that we work as a team. They understand everything. And just like with the TOP, Russ had a team in here that did a lot of the planning work, et cetera, and analysis. Dennis's team took over when we did outside presentations to sit down and talk with various stakeholders. They were just as informed and just as knowledgeable about the plan and the specifics of the plan as the consultant was. So
okay, I'm okay with this. I guess if the work is completed by the end of the year, at the board meeting it might not be required more than maybe once or twice, and certainly the executive committee would want to probably hear this. So at least for the time being, I think this makes sense. But all right, thank you.
Thank you. We do have a motion by Mr. Hall. Do I have a second? Not. Thank you, Mr. Alfres. So all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? It moves unanimously. This is a big deal. And we'll do a lot of due diligence in education and research beforehand. So with that, we're going to move on to item 32, disadvantaged business enterprise. Turn it over to staff.
Good morning. This presentation is going to discuss MTS's proposed overall DBE goal for the next triennial period on our federally assisted contracts. Per the Department of Transportation DBE regulations, any transit agency that's in receipt of federal financial assistance must establish an overall triennial goal for the participation of DBEs. We can only count certified DBEs towards our achievement of our DBE goal. And in order to become a certified DBE, the majority owner must either be a member of a minority or a woman. The majority owner must not have a personal net worth of over $1.3 million. And the firm must be both a small business and have annual gross receipts of less than $23 million. So when we say DBE, we don't necessarily mean a woman-owned business or a minority-owned business enterprise or small business. This certification is different and distinct, and sometimes even more difficult to achieve. As, for example, a small business certification, you might only need to have a certain number of employees. To calculate MTS's DBE goal, we did hire a consultant. We have GCAP Services, and here to the next to me is Ed Salcedo, the president of GCAP. And our first step to calculate our goal was to determine a base figure. And to do that, you must forecast all the federally assisted contracts you anticipate awarding in the next 3 years. So we worked with staff and decided what we needed to procure in the upcoming triennial period and what types of contracts would be expiring but we needed to renew. And based on that analysis, we found that about $47 million of federal dollars would be awarded in the next 3 years, excluding transit vehicle procurements. And that list is in your attachments A of this agenda item. It was too long for me to add into the slide, but I did add the top four that we plan to procure. Next, we figure out the categories of work we'll be awarding and find out how many DBEs are available in our geographic market area, which is San Diego, that can perform that work, and compare that to all firms, both DBE and non-DBE firms, that can perform that work. And based on that analysis, we found our base figure was 2.9%. This number shows the relative availability of DBEs compared to all firms that can do the work that we plan to procure in the next 3 years. And this number is a little low, but for a few reasons. First, there just unfortunately is no DBEs in our market area that perform some of the kinds of contracts we tend to procure, as well as even though there's some DBEs that do perform some of the work, they're very little compared to how many non-DBE firms that can do the work, and here's a list of some of those. So after you do have your base figure, you are able to adjust it, and you can adjust it based on if you have evidence of the relative availability of DBEs to perform in your market area. And so you can look at past DBE achievement in order to adjust your base figure. And since we know that in the last 3 years we'll be procuring the same types of services that we will be procuring in the next 3 years, we can look to median past DBE attainment, which here is 2.6%. Now, as background, we tend to award to DBEs preventative maintenance type of contracts. So our biggest is janitorial services. That's to NMS management. They perform janitorial services for our facilities and LRV vehicles. But otherwise, we tend to award it DBEs at smaller contracts in areas of fencing, landscaping, tree trimming, HVAC, and temporary employee staffing, for example. So we then average the base figure of 2.9% with our adjusted base figure of our DBE attainment 2.6, and our adjusted base figure is 2.7%. And after rounding up to the nearest whole number per FTA guidance, we are proposing a 3% overall DBE goal. So this means MTS aspires to award 3% of its federally assisted contracts in the next 3 years to a DBE. MTS intends to award 3% DBE contracts through race-neutral measures. So that means that DBEs winning a contract or a subcontract through customary competitive procurement procedures. They're not getting special quotas or points or advantages. They're winning just like any other firm would through low bid or best value. So to ensure we provide a level playing field so that DBEs can better compete for these contracts against larger primes, is we will be doing various outreach measures to DBEs and small business. And that can include and does include participating in small business conferences and events throughout the county, outreaching to our small business contractors to let them know about the DBE certification program and the benefits of becoming a DBE, because many might already be qualified, and advertising as much as we can on our procurements to DBEs through Planet Bids, local publications, email blasts to small business organizations, or direct email to DBE and small businesses that we know that can perform the work. Few factors to consider that do potentially reduce our chances of meeting our goal. We report semi-annually to the FTA what our achievements are towards our DBE program. But in any given reporting period, we might be awarding very large multi-year contracts to a non-DBE. So our DBE goal on a six-month period may fluctuate, but our overall aim is to achieve 3% on a triennial basis over the whole 3 years. The second, this methodology doesn't include times when we're going to award option years, sometimes very large option years to a non-DBE, for example, Transdev on fixed route. So in those reporting periods, we again will likely have a very low DBE goal. This methodology also doesn't account for things like sole sources or single bids, where in our experience, it's gone to a non-DBE firm. And lastly, although there are a lot of DBEs in construction and engineering, this analysis doesn't account for a capital program because we don't use federal funds generally for construction or engineering. So you might be more familiar with Sandag, who has a larger DBE goal, but they tend to use federal funds in their construction and engineering projects. So in conclusion, our goal was based on an analysis of how many DBEs are available to perform the types of work we pretend to procure in the next 3 years. We have very specialized and unique services, so unfortunately we just don't have many DBE firms available, but we believe it's a realistic and reasonable goal
based on our chances of successfully awarding these contracts to a DBE using race-neutral measures. And therefore, we ask that the board adopt a 3% DBE goal for the next 3 years. And myself and Ed Salcedo are available for any questions that the board may have. Thank you.
Thank you for that. Are there any questions? We have no public comment request. I don't know who came on first there, but I'll call Supervisor Cox.
Yeah, just a couple of questions. The right now, my understanding is we're meeting the 3.75 DBE goal over the three-year period. Is
yes.
that correct?
Yeah.
I know that, and David maybe can relate to this too. At the Airport Authority, they've actually developed a very good program of reaching out and with the major contractors to get them to bring in minority-owned and disadvantaged business enterprises. If we have a contract with a larger contractor, which we obviously do a lot of, can we require them, or do we require them to have a certain percentage, or do we get credit for the fact that maybe a certain percentage of their contract is going to DBE enterprises?
So we cannot require a contract-specific goal to have a certain number of DBEs. We use a race-neutral program, 100% race-neutral program. But we can count if they do happen to use a DBE subcontractor, we can use that towards our achievement goal.
We can't require them to have a certain percentage?
Right now, we're a 100% race-neutral program. So what that means is we can't use contract-specific goals. If we wanted to change our program, it would just a few notes, we could become a race-conscious program where part of our program is using contract-specific goals, but we need to do a disparity study to find evidence of discrimination in the transportation industry. We'd also need to show and prove to the FTA that we can't meet our goal using race-neutral measures. And to justify that, they look at our DBE attainment, and as you noted, we are meeting our DBE goal through race-neutral measures, so it might be difficult to show. And lastly, we would need to show that the best way to use contract-specific goals are contracts that have subcontracting opportunities and that there are DBEs able to perform. And since we don't use federal funds towards construction, which generally are the best with subcontractors, that might also be something that may limit our ability to be successful on.
Okay, so it is a goal. What is the penalty if over the three-year period you don't meet the goal?
So there's no penalties, but there are consequences. So if you do not meet your goal in a fiscal year, you do have to develop a shortfall analysis and corrective action plan that the FDA has to approve. So we have to go through an analysis about why we didn't meet our goal and what steps we believe we can improve. And if the FDA doesn't believe we're doing enough, they could find us in noncompliance with a DBE program, which could also mean an effect that to get potential federal funding in the future. So that those are consequences, although not penalties per se.
I don't know. I mean, as I look at this, since we've met the 3.75% goal over the last 3 years, I mean, I guess we could say, well, why don't we make it 2% and we can, you know, demonstrate that we excel. I'd rather have a goal out there, a 3.75. And you know, if we got to stretch to make it, then we should stretch to make it. But since we're meeting it right now, I'm a little reticent to see us drop it down to 3%. I think we have an obligation to try to reach out different parts of the community, and certainly DBEs, I think, ought to have an opportunity to get portions of these major contracts that are going out. That's just my 2 cents worth. Thank you.
Thank you for that. Mr. Diaz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For some reason, I thought last year we reached a 10%.
The last fiscal year, we did have a large goal achievement, and that was because we awarded a multi-year contract to NMS Management, who's a DBE.
Okay. So, and I agree with Supervisor Cox on this. I think we should always reach out and try to provide those small businesses with these opportunities. My question was, I was just going over all this stuff, so I kind of forgot my question, but the question is, what are we actually doing for outreach? And that was, I think he was talking about that as well.
Right. So we are part of the public agency consortium for one of our measures, and that is all the public agencies in San Diego, they meet every 2 months to discuss various small business measures that they perform and ways and strategies to increase DBE and small business participation for their own agencies. They also hold events throughout the year, and MTS both participates in the PAC and at events in terms of having a table or even presenting about information about our program. So we do that throughout the year. We also do outreach email blasts to all of our current small businesses and DBEs about different certifications, about the different programs and events that are happening to get them to be able to better compete in the marketplace. We do various advertisements towards the DBEs through Planet Bids and emails and to the small business organizations that they're a part of and in local publications so they get better notice of our procurements so that they can then bid on it and hopefully again win a contract. And we're always looking to improve. We're having more responsibility on our contract specialists to go out and do more outreach so we can improve. We want to one day also do our own procurement event here at MTS, so it's very specific to MTS's procurements. And any other measure we'll always look into, and we can always use GCAP too to do an analysis if we can improve and do different outreach measures in the future.
Do we go to trade shows?
Yes, in San Diego County, yes.
Thank you.
Council President Cool.
Supervisor Cox and Council Member.
Yes,
thank you. Asked my questions of outreach and what we're doing to make sure that we are outreaching to the people that might not have the qualifications or the money, but can eventually get up to that point. And you've answered the questions. We definitely need to, you know, do what you're doing, outreach to every social media, whatever you need to do to make sure that even in like janitorial services, I know that some people in my district has that, and we just, you know, and they might not have the opportunity to get into this, but they would like to. So just whatever you can do to reach the low-hanging fruit in a sense, I would appreciate. So thank you for this.
Just one other thing to consider. Understand that this is a requirement when we use federal dollars. So if we use local or state dollars, it doesn't go into this calculation. So we could do a procurement for janitorial services that has no federal dollars in it, and it might go all to a disadvantaged business. We don't get credit for it under this program. That's why we're always looking at it both ways. And we've had some years that have been double digit in terms of because we're using local dollars. This is just a very, you know, a very finite obligatory program from the federal government. But we spend a lot of procurement dollars with local TDA, Transnet dollars, et cetera, that don't fall into this.
Okay, thank you. Any other comments or questions for committee members? This is an action item. If I could have a motion to adopt the 3% goal for to meet the FTA DBE. Thank you. I have a motion by Mr. McWhirter, second by President Cole. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. One opposed. Mr. Diaz. Yes.
Yeah, I want to assure the board that we don't do outreach to do the goal only. I think we try to take advantage of every single outreach that we possibly can. I mean, we'd like nothing better than to exceed these goals. I know that 3% sounds like a pittance. I know that. It is a combination, and with Sandag doing a lot of our bigger construction, that really takes opportunity away from us, because construction provides good opportunity for DBEs as part of that. However, you know, procurement has standing
you know, authority and requirement to seek out every opportunity that we possibly can and be as proactive as possible, and we will continue to do that.
And just to add before we go to the next item, I'm being mindful of the conversation today, and this is a great reminder. We do have a procurement policy, and perhaps it might be time to update it or bring it back to the board and look at how we are using our local funding and have a more holistic conversation aside from this. So it seems like there's appetite for that.
Just out of curiosity, do we have a goal that we have for non-federal funding? So in other words, so that's something that could be looked at in regards
exactly.
to, okay, thank you.
Yes. So with that, thank you so much. Appreciate that. With that, we're gonna move on to the report section of our agenda. We're gonna invite staff to report on the San Diego Metropolitan Transit System marketing. We've been doing a lot of marketing. Some exciting things have been going on, so.
Thank you, Chair.
Of course.
I'll get set up. Yeah, it's been several years since I've come before the board and just give a general overview of all of the efforts that marketing is taking to support all of the initiatives at MTS. I've set this up kind of as a show and tell, and so in that vein, I've left a few things at your seats this morning. One of them is our community impact and performance report. Another is our internal newsletter called Connections, and there's also a nice little flash drive at your seats that has all of the video work that we've been doing. One of our goals for this year is really increase the communications that we do on that medium. Didn't want to take up a lot of time today with that, but it has all of the stuff that we've been doing in terms of promotions, HEP A kind of public service announcements on how to protect yourselves. All of that kind of stuff is in there. And I also want to show off the staff. They're sitting here to my left in the second and third rows back there. Certainly don't get this all done by myself. It takes a great team, and I've got one of those. And then there's all kinds of cooperation with all the departments in MTS to get it done. It literally takes the village to get a lot of this stuff done. One person that couldn't join us today is Julie Andrews. She's been with the agency and MTDB for 36 years. She's retiring at the end of this year. So I think Wayne Terry is the only guy that's been here longer than that. So, just going to give you an overview of all of the disciplines within marketing. Public relations is one of the big ones. That community impact report that's in front of you, that's going to be mailed to 3,000 stakeholders in San Diego this week. Those are going out now. The intent of that is really to show the impact that transit makes in our community. We did one in 2016, and this one in 2018 is also kind of geared to like looking at transit in a different way and asking a series of what if questions. What if we invested more in transit? What if we invested more in TOD and those kinds of things to get people thinking that, you know, everybody can make a big difference in supporting public transit. So I'm a big believer in going out in the community and meeting with people. We've hired a team that helps us do that. And last year we had 70 community relations events that we went to, from street fairs to festivals, those kinds of things, and made it really important that we went into each one of your cities and had significant presence there and talked to people, hand out our collateral, and encourage them to ride transit. We also initiated last year a travel training program. That's in conjunction with the City of San Diego. Met a few times, over 200 seniors and first-time riders, telling them how to access transit. Really, our goal is to kind of double that outreach effort this year. And then we did a lot of work to support the top outreach. We did lots of outreach sessions, helped the planning department with the survey to get good input from everybody. Media relations, we've got a big component of what we do. You know, the earned media value of those efforts is $600,000, increased our presence by 28% over the previous year. We're averaging a news release every week talking about service and progress that we're making in the system.
news conferences. You know, Mark Olson does most of our media relations, and I tease Mark. Mark gets like 6 cameras every news conference we do, so that's his new over-under. You know, if he gets 6, he's okay. If he gets 7, all right, that's a good job. And we've also increased our presence in trade media just to increase our value throughout the United States. Internal communications, another big audience for us, 2,500 employees. It's, you know, to a large part, they're the front line of our communications effort. We got bus drivers, trolley operators, security, ambassadors. So to the extent they know what's going on in our system, the better they can communicate to our customers. We do that through that quarterly newsletter that you have, the latest edition in front of you. CEO Advance is an electronic email that Paul sends out telling our employees what's coming up, you know, so they're prepared for events that are coming up. And then we also organize CEO exchanges in which Paul goes out and talks to all of our departments, whether it be, you know, mechanics or bus operators in every one of our divisions. So again, it gives our employees direct access to Paul, allows them to ask questions, and it works beautifully. We also have an internal program that's largely an HR effort, the meet and greet, but every other month or so we introduce our new employees, and we recognize people that have been here for 5, 10, 15, 20 years and longer. And Paul also makes kind of comments in that to get people up to speed and allows people to ask questions. Other newsletters we do is MTS Express. That's on our onboard newsletter. We do 40, 50,000 of those every quarter. We also initiated an electronic version this year. We call that Rider Insider. We did meet our goal to increase that by, I can't remember our goal, but we're up to 3,800. We really want to increase that. But that gives people who subscribe to us chances to win little prizes, to get information that's not readily accessible to other riders. And then we also help the trolley department put out an internal newsletter to their group. In terms of advertising, we do all of the creative heretofore. We've done all the creative and buying. There you can kind of see where we spread out our money. We spent, Jessica takes care of this. She's got spreadsheets. If you want to know exactly where we spend our money, I've got the spreadsheet to prove it. But about $300,000, and we're getting over 300 million impressions. So less than a dollar per impression. And I think we're really stretching our dollar there in that we do all the creative ourselves. We do all the media buying. So we're not paying markup, and we're not paying an agency to create that for us. The pie chart there shows the medias that we buy. That last, the one in green with digital, I think that's going to be a much growing segment as we go forward and try to really segment our audiences. Again, we do partnerships with all the cities in which we have members here. We did 20 of them last year. What I demand of our partners is that they encourage people to ride transit to their events. So that's kind of the trade-off. We buy ads and we advertise their events. They buy ads and advertise riding transit. You know all about our naming rights partnerships, but you know, when people are spending $600,000 on a partnership, they can't expect some kind of return. We put this book together for UC San Diego each year that shows off all of the assets that they've earned through their partnership, from signage to brochures. It's a pretty colorful book. So if you want to take a look at that, that's here. Customer information, huge, huge effort to get information out to our customers. We do that in all the expected ways, the website. I'll go into some of the metrics real quickly on some of these things later, but website. Intranet is how we communicate with our internal audiences. Social media here is one of our big efforts. Stacy Bishop heads that up, and we've integrated our video components in that. Stacy goes out and does field trip Fridays every other Friday or so, and those are getting a lot of traction. So if you want to follow us, you know, just search for at SDMTS, and you can get up-to-date information. We usually use Twitter for service announcements, alerts. So when something goes wrong, people who subscribe to us can get updates as to what's happening with our service. Timetables, Melinda does this. You can see kind of in the background all of the work that's in there, but all of our timetables, if you've looked through them, have very good maps. They have all of the, they're really intricate. And when you do something like TOP and change 60% of your routes, puts a lot of pressure on Melinda to get these things done right, and she does that. We also have created station-specific signage for all of our trolleys, showing exactly when the trolley is going to show up. So we have a lot of unique signs that really takes a lot of effort to keep those up to date. The board, a gentleman has come to the board a couple of times and talked about better getting out our collateral, about fun places to go. We do have a contract with a firm that distributes our collateral to over 500 locations, hotels, to typical places where visitors are going, those standard brochure racks. We're putting out, I guess they're going through more than 7,500 of our regional transit maps and our fun places to go brochures every month. So that's been really successful. And station signage, not only do we have the printed stuff, but we've gone into electronic. We have pylons on Broadway that we push out information to, real-time information. We've also been integral in the mobile phone apps, One Bus Away, and our website, too, has been redone to be mobile-first solution. So these stats on the left are web metrics. We're getting almost 1 million page views a month on our website. That's relatively flat from last year. So hopefully all of our efforts to increase ridership boost that number this year. We did see a big increase in the mobile use of our website. That was up by 7%. And then our efforts to increase ridership on routes like the 992 to the airport, that tripled the amount of people that are being referred to our site from the airport site, so that's good too. And then we do a lot of work, as you know, with UC San Diego, and their students have really adopted the UPass, and so a lot of referrals to our site are coming from UCSD. Here's a kind of in the background, there is the collateral that we distribute. We kind of redid that so it stands out on those big racks that are full of brochures. Our distributor says that's working really well. The regional transit map shows all of our routes, all of the frequency. Fun Places goes through about 30 of the destinations that people can use transit to get there. We have brochures on how to use your compass card, where the vintage trolley goes, how to ride. You know, one of the barriers of riding is really understanding, you know, how to pay a fare, where do I pay a fare, how do I use a ticket vending machine. So we've got a brochure that kind of goes through all of that. Also pictured there is the mini trolley pocket guide that people use, and that is really popular as well. One of our big efforts this year was to promote Compass Cloud, which is the mobile ticketing app, and Compass Cash, which is the ability to put stored value on your Compass card. Had really good success with both. The cloud, we've got over 141,000 accounts. We're doing about 40,000 day passes a month, worth $403,000 in sales. That number is high too because we partner with North County, and so you've got coaster passes in there that bring up the average dollar. Compass Cash, yeah, we're doing pretty well there too. 25,000 one-ways are being purchased with their stored value a month, and 1,700 day passes. So we're doing about $5,500 in sales a month with Compass Cash. We also support other projects. One of the biggest initiatives of our security department was kind of to rebrand the See Something, Say Something campaign. It was in conjunction with the adoption of their BEAT system. We rebranded this throughout our vehicles. That's getting real good success. I think our calls are up, texting and calls are up, so people are feeling comfortable with this. Our customers go up to our inspectors and say, hey, I recognize you. I saw you in that card. So that's doing well. We support other groups in putting together awards packages. So when, you know, we're kind of part of the team that puts together a package for bus or for rail when they go to APTA and get safety awards. Some of the other stuff that falls under our purview are contracts for advertising. Advertising now is over about $2.5 million a year, and that includes vehicle advertising, shelters, and bus benches. When you throw in our naming rights partnerships that we manage, we're well over $3.7 million a year. We also manage the the placement of new benches and shelters. We put in 1,500 benches last year. That program has been completed. We still have some more benches if we want to expand that program. And I just got word today that we are pretty much finished replacing all of our shelters, and we do have more capacity. We've got another 150 or so shelters that we can purchase, so we're working with planning to look where we can put those throughout our system to provide more passenger amenities. Kind of transitioning into what we've got going, we're working real hard to support those top changes, especially on those corridors that we've added capacity and frequency. We've got a beach route campaign going on now. We have been promoting the airport route for the past couple of years, and largely due to that we've added frequency on the weekend, but that ridership is up 8%. We just had an event on the I-15 corridor on Tuesday in which we got new choice riders to try out the system that day, as well as hand out stuff to our long supportive riders. So that was a community, that was a ridership appreciation event as well. I think the ridership on the 235, Rapid 235, is up 4% year over year. So efforts there are succeeding. 950, we really haven't worked to promote that, but the 950 is such great service. I think ridership on that route was up like 22%. That's an express service from Otay Mesa to Iris. So that's really popular with people coming over the border at the Otay Mesa border crossing. We are now transitioning into this Choose Transit campaign. It's a fairly direct campaign. We really want people to start considering transit as a choice, as a mode of choice. It's a phased approach, and we launched this with some billboards that just said Choose Transit with a strong image of our buses and trolleys. We're phasing that in now to highlight some of the people that have chosen transit, and we're doing that in print and television. I forgot digital on here, which is a big component of that. We've partnered with the City of San Diego in their Transit Tuesdays initiative. So we're gaining voices in that, and I think that's real important as we go forward to get the support of everyone around this table and their cities to encourage transit use. Just to give you a flavor, I did load up a couple of videos. I'll just show one of these videos to give you a flavor of what we're trying to do. So we have a series of those ads. What we're really trying to do with this campaign is highlight the values that are important to people, and then to associate those, to transit to those values. So we're highlighting people who are active in the community, care about their community, and because of that, they do take transit. We have the millennial that you just saw. We have the next gentleman there is an artist and student. We have a Hispanic dad and his daughter that's concerned about the future. And we have a working mom that actually uses transit to get some downtime and enjoy her life too. So that's ongoing. We're building up to a free ride day. This is going to be on October 2nd. It's going to be in conjunction with Rideshare Week. But this is our opportunity to really expand our voice. I mean, MTS can go out there and give people all the reasons to ride transit, but I need help. I need help from all of you and all of the cities. We're putting together a toolkit and planning to come to your city councils. We're trying to set that up now with your managers. But I think the opportunity here is for all of us to, like, you know, climate action plans depend on getting people into alternate modes. So the more that you can encourage your employees and your constituents to choose transit, the more success we're all going to have. So that's October 2nd in conjunction with Sandag's Rideshare Week. It's a Transit Tuesday. Hopefully we'll have a news conference with mayors. UCSD will be there because they're a big, strong partner of ours and have encouraged transit use since 1960. So they'll be there, but I think this is a real opportunity for us all to create momentum behind this opportunity to choose transit. And then I'm not suggesting that all of this is all that we can do or is the best way, and I'm really looking forward to getting Civilian on board with us because one of their first tactics, we're working through all of these task orders, but what I really want them to do is do an audit of the work that we're doing, talk to staff members beyond marketing, and really come up with a comprehensive long-range plan that kind of builds on this Choose Transit opportunity. We're going to do this marketing plan. They've promised me a quick win, so I think we're going to look at the corridors where we can really make an improvement and fast. And then again, they're going to be really involved in the educational component of the ballot measure. Task order two is to establish those strong quantitative goals that we can come back to the board on a quarterly basis and give reports on progress. So that's a quick overview of what we do. Open for questions.
Thank you for that great presentation. Mayor Salas.
Yes. Thank you very much, and I really love the Choose Transit campaign. And I think that, you know, in the city of Chula Vista, we have a great opportunity to assist you with marketing that. Mm-hmm. And especially beneficial to us because it kind of coincides with the opening of the BRT. And I think the signage is really fresh and modern, and I think that it speaks to a younger audience that, mm-hmm. We have to turn the image around from taking the bus to being, a nerdy thing to a cool thing, right? And so I wanted to ask you, are you working with our communications department?
Yeah, we're working with Ann a lot. And in fact, I forgot to mention our efforts is in September to help mm-hmm. launch the pilot of the South Bay BRT. Mm-hmm. So that service begins day after Labor Day, and we'll have a big effort there to make sure we get riders on that.
Mm-hmm. And I know that at least I have my own Facebook page, and I think that some of the other council members do as well. And so it's a great thing to encourage some kind of a link or, presence on our particular Facebook pages as well, if you reach out to elected officials to, broaden the audience that way as well.
Okay, we'll do that. And, I kind of went that through hurriedly, and I skipped over, we hired Marcial this year to really emphasize our South Bay connections. Marcial's had a long history working in the South Bay. Hispanic speakers. So our efforts to reach Hispanic speakers through this Hispanic media has been improved, and then Marcial has a real keen knowledge of the communities down there and has really upped our game in terms of reaching out to them.
Thank you. Councilmember Bragg.
Thank you. Mr. Shoup, thank you for this. You know that this is one of my favorite reports, and I love everything that MTS is doing to encourage the county, residents in the county, to use transit and choose transit. I did have a couple of comments I just wanted to make generally, and one addresses the travel training that has happened with our stakeholders, and I too am hopeful that we'll have more people get more comfortable with choosing transit and riding transit. And that kind of leads into your slide on the videos. I would appreciate it if one of those slides captured a senior riding mm-hmm. transit, because we have found that when we can get seniors onto transit that their world just expands. And then also people with disabilities. And we saw how transformational when the blue line, the low floor cars came into effect, how transformational that was for people with disabilities. And they didn't have to use our paratransit. So mm-hmm. I think that might be a really inspirational slide as well. And I just wanted to mention that the last time I used Amtrak and was arriving at Santa Fe Depot, the train conductor was announcing some of the bus routes and the trolley. Mm-hmm. So I didn't know if that was your good work. I'm going to assume that it was.
Well, we have reached out to Amtrak and to the coaster because Santa Fe Depot is that hub where you can get to the airport. You can get all three of our trolley lines and Rapid, too. We want to promote the ability to just step outside the front door of the Santa Fe Depot there, get on Rapids, and go up Broadway. So it's an alternative just to downtown travel as well.
I thought that was awesome. I did have a question on the ridership campaign, the Choose Transit Beach bus, and was wondering, could the bus that goes from Palm Avenue to Seacoast Drive and Imperial Beach could be designated as a beach bus as well? In my community, I'm always encouraging people to take the bus to the beach. They complain about no parking. I tell them, get on the bus.
We'll look at that. We certainly on the website encourage, we include all of the bus routes that go to PV, OB, and Imperial Beach. But if I'll take a look at what we can do in Imperial Beach.
All right, Rob, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Supervisor Cox.
Yeah, Rob, could you put up slide 7? I just wanted to give you more credit than you claimed. The budget says you spend less than $300,000 to get $321 million, and I think you said that it's less than a dollar per impression, which is true, but it's
per
actually
thousand. Yeah.
Okay, it's actually less than a tenth of a cent per impression.
Right.
And that's really remarkable, and a great job you're doing.
Thank you.
Yes, I think some of us noticed that. Vice Chair Rios.
Thank you, Chair. I too want to thank you for the presentation. I think it was wonderful, and you said it with such pride, and I believe that you should be prideful about this, bringing the staff out so we can also associate names with faces, I think is an important. And one of the things I wanted to mention was not only that I really appreciate the newsletter and the report, but how the format was set up. I think it was not only talking about real time, but talking about real people and their experiences and how we connect that with Choose Transit. I think that's important. I do want to say this last year, I have really appreciated in part of what Mayor Sulla said and how we can get that information out to our community. And Mark Olson has sent out emails every time there's been, and very, very great detail, I might add, every time there's been changes in our transit for either events happening or holiday changes to all of our transportation. And I have taken the time to cut and paste and to post that on my social media. But if there's an opportunity to even make that a little easier by having a link, because I'm not getting the type of calls I had gotten previously from my community to say, hey, what's going on here? But now I can get ahead of that, and I could provide that information, and it's really made a difference. So thank you.
Councilmember Saff, I'm not sure if it's Saff or Hall. I can't figure it. Okay, Hall.
I appreciate it, too. I just wanted to see if we can get together about doing something in Santee about the new bus routes going through. So if we can maybe get some tables set up or something like that.
Okay.
You know, I'm sure the mayor and I would both be there.
Okay, thank you.
There you go. Cities are joining the efforts. Councilmember Diaz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Rob, yeah, excellent presentation. So a couple of things. I just want to tag on to Mayor Salas's comments on the media. Would it be possible to give us, for the electeds anyways, media-friendly artwork that we can use?
Sure.
So people can
So one of the tactics before we we're putting together that toolkit, exactly what you're asking for, so that your cities can put information on your websites that does exactly that.
Yeah. In like different sizes too, because I know like I'll send out a newsletter to my constituents, but we need small graphics, big graphics for our so like a kit, that would be awesome.
Okay.
But the other thing too, with regards to the access, I agree with Lori that we probably should also use graphics with the disabled and seniors and all that. And you're talking about access to the trolleys, and this morning it just hit me this morning because a lot of times we'll just jump on the trolley and we don't think about folks that are, that can't get on as easily or whatever. And this morning I just was getting on and there was a mother in a stroller and I jumped on real quick, try to get to the other door to help her, and it was a nice ramp. It was all even and I go, phew. So great work on that. And just like, you know, so, and those are things that we should be talking to people about, the, mm-hmm. how easy it is to get on and off. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay.
Councilmember Mendoza.
Hi. The free ride day, what a great idea. I became a more frequent transit user when I first realized that on, what was it, the bike to work day, you can ride your bike to the trolley and get on for free and do part of your ride, because I'm not as young as I used to be, and so I don't really want to ride all the way from Lemon Grove to downtown, but I can ride to the station and then take the trolley. But in promoting that, I would welcome you to our city, and I'm going to ask our city manager to see if we can set that up. But also promote that with school districts, colleges, because I don't know if anyone has noticed, but when school's out, the roads are a lot clearer. And then, you know, come September or late August, there's just a zillion roads or cars back on the road again. And then finally, you know, I travel a lot, and you kind of have a sense when you go to certain cities that you don't need to rent a car. You can use their public transportation. And I would like to see us market San Diego as a city that you don't, I feel like too many travelers come to San Diego mm-hmm. and they have to rent a car, they have to rent a car. Look at that huge car rental facility that has just been built. You don't see that in a lot of cities. We're like a car rental travel destination, and I'd rather see us become a transit user travel destination. So anything in your marketing that, you know, to like convention center right. visitors, especially like we
do have a partnership with the convention center and their meeting planners. So we advertise in their publications every year, encouraging big conventions to even include transit passes in their packages. So that's an ongoing effort.
I think along that too is what we just experienced last week with Comic-Con, big event, highly publicized, a lot of marketing on our part to get people to use transit. The numbers are not finalized, but I think there are around 380,000 additional trips for that event. So it was a substantial increase from last year.
And mobile ticketing for Comic-Con was up 30%, so that's really gaining momentum as well.
Well, thank you. It seems like there's a lot of excitement and a lot of great work that you and your team are doing. I was thinking, I was hearing my committee members, perhaps as we ourselves are taking transit, and I know a lot of us do, we should promote that as well, because I think it's something that the team can utilize as well, be that example. So thank you, very exciting, a lot of work to do, but it's looking good. So with that, we're gonna move on to the another report on the operations budget status.
Good morning. We're looking at the operating budget update through the first 11 months of the year through May of this past year. Sorry. We usually start with operating revenue. Operating revenue in total was favorable by $561,000, or 0.6%. We are continuing to see ridership declines. Either year-over-year ridership is down 3.1% overall, and that was the same in April and in May. We were down year-over-year, so we haven't yet stopped that ridership decline. We are unfavorable on the passenger fare revenue line by $400,000. It's a 0.5% unfavorable variance. But we are making that up on other operating revenues that we have within our budget. We're about $1 million ahead on those lines. So, and overall, we are favorable on operating revenue for the first 11 months. On the expense side, we are slightly unfavorable. personnel costs are unpayable by about $400,000 or 0.3%. And also other expenses unfavorable by 3.8% or almost $900,000. The other expenses is primarily expenses unfavorable experience within risk management. Our liability costs are higher than we had projected. And then also material supply costs is costing more than we initially projected. So those are driving that large variance. It is being partially offset by favorable variances within our purchase transportation on the fixed route side. And then energy is actually coming in very close to budget. We are very favorable on compressed natural gas costs, but we are unfavorable on electricity. Electricity is costing a lot more than we had projected. But those are netting each other out, thankfully, and we're very close to budget on that line. So in total, it's $845,000 unfavorable on the operating expenses for 11 months. And when you roll those two together, revenue less expenses, we are unfavorable by about $300,000. That's a 0.2%. We do have one more month to go, and this does not include any of our subsidy revenues. So in the next board meeting, we'll be able to present the full year look and look at subsidy as well and see how we are doing. We are hopeful that we are going to achieve our budget with a positive variance when all that is accounted for. Looking at our large ongoing concerns, our sales tax revenues are coming in where they were planned to come in, so that should be positive at year end on that subsidy side. That's TD and Transnet primarily. Our state transit assistant revenue should be coming ahead of what was originally planned. This Senate Bill 1 revenues are included with that as well. That is stronger over the last couple quarters than it had been, and we have one more quarter to go. That should be a very favorable number. Passenger levels we talked about. Then energy prices, again, CNG has been favorable. The cost of gas has been very low. Usually that trends very well with electricity commodity costs, but it's the demand costs on the SDG&E side that are really, they change the window of when peak is, and that has a very negative impact on us. That started in January, and we're really seeing the effects of that over 5 months. So that number is unfavorable and probably will continue to be unfavorable through FY19 as well. So that concludes my presentation. We'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for that report. Are there any questions from committee members? I see not. That's a reflection of a great report. Thank you. So we're going to move on to the, there's no report from the ad hoc ballot measure since we didn't meet, but our next meeting is September 7th at 1:30 for those that want to join. There's no report from the chair report and executive.
Yeah, I just wanted to highlight, I think I emailed you all, but just wanted to highlight, we finished up our federal triennial review, and we got another perfect score, no findings. That is the fourth one in a row, so 12 years of no findings at the federal level. I don't think it's been achieved in this industry, and that's, I think the FTA confirmed that. So great credit to staff and our finance department, and our grants administration, and it is 23 different categories across the whole organization, from maintenance to operations to scheduling to DBE to all the things that you also hear. So great effort.
Yes, thank you for that. Any board member communications I would like to share with us? Seeing none, we are adjourned. Our next meeting is September 20th, 2018, and enjoy your August.